Scholars tend to think of the Pax Romana at its height, that is from the reign of Trajan in AD 98 through the reign of Marcus Aurelius to AD 180, as being at the pinnacle of prosperity and its economic and military power. And in a sense, compared to what came after, that's true. The second century looks like a golden age compared to the crisis that emerged in the mid-third century. But despite the high achievements of the Pax Romana, it's an open question as to whether Rome's impressive and highly populated cities were actually as healthy as we might think. In this episode, I want to directly tackle the sanitation infrastructure of the Roman Empire. The baths, the sewers, the aqueducts, monumental and technological wonders that historians often associate with progress and health and well-being, but I'm not so sure, and I'm going to tell you why on this episode of the Pax Romana podcast. Episode 41, Aqueducts, Baths, and Sewers, Sanitation of the Roman Empire. For the next few episodes, I'm going to draw from my new book, Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World. One of the arguments of the book is that the Pax Romana often gets a much nicer treatment than it deserves, and that includes even in areas like technology and sanitation. And so as we think about prosperity in the Pax Romana over the next few episodes, I'd like to look, beginning today, at sanitation and health and just living life in the world that we've been talking about. So far, we've been looking a lot at the lives of emperors and elites at the top of Roman society. And while we don't have a lot of direct sources that tell us about the lives of normal citizens, some of my recent research attempts to get a little closer to the Roman Empire that normal people actually lived in. I should warn you, though, some of the contents of these next few episodes will be a little gritty, maybe even disgusting at times. Roman cities were quite filthy and quite deadly. So make sure your stomach's in a good place, and let's go ahead and get to this episode. If you were ever to visit Pompeii. At the back corner of the city is the House of the Vettii, and it is a marvel of opulence. Go into the atrium. There still survives some of the intricate wall paintings, and if you go at the right time of day, the natural light will cascade through an open rectangular skylight into a basin below. Originally, that was filled with water, and if the rain were coming down through the skylight, it would tumble down in a beautiful cascading waterfall right into that first room of the house. In fact, the entire property enjoyed pools and fountains, murals, gardens, statues, reception rooms, and this is just one house in just one city in a vast and sprawling empire of cities. Now today, Pompeii is filled with tourists. But before Vesuvius buried it in ash, the city had no shortage of people far less affluent than those that lived in domiciles like the House of the Vettii. The citizens of modest incomes dwelt in smaller, moderately outfitted homes, almost like glue squished between the carpenter's wood. Their residences were crammed, occupying the spaces between the larger homes of the elite. Many Pompeian citizens lived in tenement blocks, in cramped rooms, with very little furniture, just bedding. Sometimes more than one family would live in one of these apartment rooms. But at least they had walls and a roof. Perhaps thousands of inhabitants of Pompeii could not find regular housing. They slept in shadowy alleys, in bushes, some of them even with the dead in tombs. These transients might very well have huddled on cold nights against the very walls that made up elite houses, shielding them from the poverty just a few feet away. During the summer, no doubt beggars crowded the streets looking for coins, prostitutes advertised their prices and the things they were willing to do, We even have stories in the sources of alms seekers disrupting funerals and weddings and refusing to leave until they were paid. And so already we see a difference between modern cities and ancient cities. Many in the United States, for example, pay good money to live in gated communities or suburbs that function like them. But there was far less segregation in the neighborhoods of Roman cities. The reek of campfires, the burning of oil lamps easily made its way into the houses of elites. And likely one of the first signs that a person has been living in a Roman city for very long is the development of coughs and respiratory diseases as they suffocated on the sooty air. And inside, things weren't all that better. Domestic pets, but also uninvited rodents and vermin easily found their way into Roman houses, even those made of stone. And some of these uninvited guests were invisible to the naked eye. Water always had to be boiled, and if it wasn't, it was likely teeming with bacteria and parasites. Refuse was thrown out of the house and onto the street or into a back alley. As carts and pedestrians moved about these streets, they trudged the rotten food, blood, urine, feces, vomit, insects, and bacteria into an ever-present coating of sludge that would glom on to anybody who ventured outside, caking their feet and legs, which was far more than just mud. We know from Pompeii that some of this refuse must have been human feces because we find signage still scrawled on the walls of the city, warning people not to defecate in certain areas or to at least leave and defecate somewhere else. Two bright red inscriptions in one alley in between apartment buildings in Pompeii gives this warning: defecator, watch out for what might happen to you. Another etching reads, if you must defecate, pass by this place for good luck. But what about sewers? Didn't Rome have an impressive sewer system? Well, yes, they did. And so did a few other cities. But the sewers in Rome were largely meant to alleviate flooding and to drain standing water. Rome, after all, was built on a swamp. And the Tiber often flooded. And when that happened, far from cleaning Rome, the sewers became a constant source of rodents, pests, and noxious gases. Clogged sewers quickly became stinking cesspits. They were, of course, as you might imagine, great places for hiding bodies. In sewers in one city in Palestine, archaeologists found the remains of nearly 100 newborn babies. And at the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, the bodies of an emperor or two were reportedly stuffed down sewers at various points in Roman history. Rome had its corpse cleaners, as did other cities. This meant at least that cadavers didn't pile up. But there were plenty of back alleys and refuse piles where a corpse might escape notice, eventually begin rotting, and then nobody really wanted to clean it up. What typically happened at this point, even in a city like Rome, is that animals tore at pieces of corpses. And that would include, by the way, exposed infants. Romans preferred boys over girls, and if there was often any defect or disability in a newborn, the poor child was left for somebody else to find, and that was a best-case scenario. We have numerous anecdotes in literary sources about bodies on the street, and those anecdotes would only work in an urban environment where death was not only highly visible, but could at times inject its gruesome presence in the daily routines of the living. At least some neighborhoods in Rome and other Roman cities could be cleaned by aqueduct water. We know that during the 2nd century AD, Rome enjoyed 10 working aqueducts, and these supplied the city with millions of liters of fresh water each day. That's enough to provide 100 liters of water per person per day, but that's assuming that the water was for drinking. It's easy to imagine abundant fountains in the city of Rome providing drinking water. In fact, if you go to Rome to this day, you can't go more than 500 meters in any direction without finding running water available to drink or to wash your hands or feet. But the water that came in 2,000 years ago through the aqueducts was often unfit for drinking. It contained excessive fluorine and also was brought in with lead pipes. We have reports in the writings of the Greek physician Galen that at least one aqueduct gave people diarrhea when they drank its water. But most of the water brought in by the aqueducts did not go for drinking. It was purely for ornamental purposes, to create fountains and waterfalls in the meeting places, baths and barracks and arenas dedicated to the emperors. Only about 40% of the water from aqueducts went for private use, and these only to people wealthy enough to pay the Roman water tax. So while the aqueducts are impressive to behold and were a technological wonder, that was basically the point. The aqueducts were there to promote the glory of Rome, not to actually sanitize the city and provide drinking water for anybody who wanted it. Some of that aqueduct water went into city baths. And again, here we might get the wrong impression. When many of us in the Western world go to take a bath, the water is clean. We have soap and shampoo. It flows through a shower head or fills a tub for a brief period of time before we drain it out. Every time we take a bath or a shower, the water is fresh and clean and chemically treated. As you might imagine, none of these things applied to the bath water that the Romans enjoyed. That water was often tepid at best. It cycled purely through overflow and often just sat in bathhouses, which were basically urban ponds. Many doctors suggested that their sick patients go to the baths to wash off their infectious sores. The city's poorest prostitutes, which had no home of their own, found the bath a great place to do business with their customers. Of course, the Romans, like just about anybody throughout time, also peed in their bathwater. We have sources that actually discuss that too. Cockroaches and other bugs loved the damp and dark environment of Roman public baths. The Emperor Marcus Aurelius, in his Meditations, said of Roman baths, and he would have bathed in the nicest Roman baths, quote, "What is bathing when you think of it? Oil, sweat, filth, greasy water, everything revolting." That's Marcus Aurelius in his Meditations. So the sanitation infrastructure of the Pax Romana presents a complex picture. Even to this day, Rome's gleaming marbles and triumphant arches inspire the popular imagination, suggesting cities of wonders, technology, and sanitation. But 2,000 years ago, reality was far less glamorous. Many inhabitants of Roman cities endured a brutal existence, constantly battling poverty, disease, and just the elements themselves. And it's good to acknowledge these harsh realities alongside the stories of emperors and wars and other grand relics of the Pax Romana. The history of the Roman Empire, indeed even the Pax Romana, reminds us that the glitter of this empire masks a multitude of struggles for the majority of its citizens. We're reminded that while the Roman Empire was truly prosperous and powerful, like so much of the Pax Romana, not everything was exactly as it seemed. And so on the next episode, we'll continue to examine the prosperity of the Pax Romana while also examining the darker and grittier side of life in this mighty and terrifying empire.
Thanks for listening to the Pax Romana podcast. For more information, including a list of primary sources and further reading, check the show notes. Music by Red Productions and Exocor. Follow Dr. Colin Elliott on X at ProfCPE or email colin@paxromanapodcast.com. Listen to more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just about anywhere podcasts are available. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.